AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to another Empire Podcast interview special. Paul Reiser is a multi-hyphenate of some distinction. He is a stand-up comedian, an actor who just happens to have starred in some of my favorite movies of all time, a writer, and a producer. And he wears three of those hats in this week's charming comedy, The Problem with People, in which he plays a brash New York property developer who goes to Ireland to meet family he never knew he had, principally in the shape of the irascible Colmeany. Do sparks fly? Did the two butt heads after rubbing shoulders before possibly putting their differences aside? Well, that's not for me to say, but what I will say is that I had a good time with the film and leapt at the chance to talk to Reiser when it was afforded to me. Now, this was meant to be a 20-minute chat that would have lived comfortably on this week's regular Empire podcast, but in the end, we spoke for about 45 minutes and I had such a good time talking with Reiser that I decided to make this a special and bring you nearly every second of those 45 minutes in which we talk about The Problem with People, of course, and Aliens, obviously, in which he starred as the treacherous collar-sporting Carter Burke, and his return of sorts to the character in a comic book that he co-wrote this year. We also spoke about his incredible start in movies, where he made the likes of Diner, Aliens, Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2, in his first few years as an actor, and we spoke at length about his time working with Peter Falk, one of my heroes, of course, on another very personal indie that Reiser made called The Thing About My Folks, and we spoke about his time making Whiplash with Damien Chazelle. I loved talking with Paul Reiser, and I hope you guys will enjoy listening to it. Here we are. Do please enjoy.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star producer and co-writer of The Problem with People, but not director. I'm going to get into that in a second. Paul Reiser, how are you, sir?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
No, thanks for being here. So, you wrote this thing. You produced this thing.
Yes.
You starred in this thing. But, Paul, you didn't direct it. What's going on?
That's true. Well, you know, this movie meant so much to me. The last thing I wanted to do is put it in the hands of a guy who doesn't know what he's doing. So I've never directed. So I went, you know, let me get a part. I guess some people have commented that it's odd. I've never had an aspiration to direct. I feel as producer and writer, I have all the input that I could want. Where I could say, here's how I think this should be, or gee, that location is not what I was picturing, or gee, that wardrobe, whatever it is, you know, or gee, let's change this line, or let's do that. And everything else, it's like, now let somebody else. And we have a terrific director, Chris Cottam, who was really great and funny. And he came on board early with this. He read the script and asked for a meeting, which is always flattering. It's like, oh, he actually wants to. I don't have to pursue him. He wants to do this. And I had seen his work, and he was great and funny and visually creative. For me, it was great to have. I never even considered directing. I was really delighted to have a partner who, you know, certainly beyond knew what he was doing and added so much. And then I was free to just be the actor when time came.
Absolutely. But it's interesting you say you've never had aspirations to direct, because you've worked with some amazing directors over the years. I mean, I think four of the first five directors you worked with in movies were Barry Levinson, Jim Cameron, Martin Brest, and Tony Scott. That is not a bad way to start off.
Yeah, that's the one. I never thought of that. Yeah. You know, it's all been crazy luck. I mean, at the time when I, you know, Diner with Barry Levinson was my first, not just my first movie, it was my first job. I never did anything in front of a camera. And at the time, Barry Levinson wasn't Barry Levinson. That was his first movie, too. So I didn't even have enough sense to go, I don't know if this guy knows what he's doing. I was just so thrilled to be invited to be in a movie. And it was an MGM movie. So there was the logo was on the cover of the MGM lion. I went, wow, this is big time. It's got a lion on the script and there's trucks with cameras. Wow. So I, you know, and then it turned out to be a brilliant film and Barry Levinson turned out to be Barry Levinson. So go figure.
That's true. And I guess Martin Brest wasn't Martin Brest when he directed Beverly Hills Cop. He turned out to be Martin Brest later.
Yeah, well, he had done Going in Style, which was one of my favorite movies.
It's a great movie.
And it turns out we went to high school, not quite together. He was a year ahead of me or something, or a year or two ahead of me, but went to the same high school. But that was another one where, you know, now that I'm hearing myself speak, I'm like, I was just so happy to be invited to all of these. You know, Marty Brett, Beverly Hills Cop, I had a little bitty part, and, you know, and I there was not a lot of pressure. And I had known Eddie Murphy from the comedy club. So it was, you know, this is going to be fun. And then Jim Cameron, I did know who Jim Cameron was. And he already was Jim Cameron, you know, not quite who he became, but he had already done Terminator and was obviously quite, quite skilled. And that was an occasion where I knew enough to know, oh, this is going to be a monster hit. This is a great script. And you know, it's one of the rare occasions, and maybe the only occasion, where you read the script and you're like, it's like watching a movie. I mean, I remember sweating and having to put it down to take a break. And the action. And it's just words on a page. I'm going, oh, my gosh, this is crazy. So I knew that was going to be a hit. And again, like, okay, the fact that you invited me to be in this mega hit, I'm not going to question your judgment, but you might be crazy. But thank you.
Well, it was interesting. So you weren't necessarily soaking up sort of directorial influences from these gentlemen.
I still don't. I just tell me where to go, and I'll bring in my thoughts. And you know, there's a level, there's a skill set. I think you need to be a director is to have an overview and to have constant, crisp focus. And that's not a skill I have. And visually, you know, I've never, even when I've asked, I can't retain what kind of lens is that? What does that mean? So that's further, that's closer, that's wider, whatever. Just fucking tell me where to go. it's just not, I've had enough input as creator and producer and writer or even as actor that I've never felt, gee, I need more control. You know, I'm thrilled to be part of somebody else's sandbox.
Yeah, but it is fascinating to me. I mean, obviously the problem with people as well is something that you co-wrote, and you know, you've been such a prolific writer over the years. So was that something that you came into the industry really wanting to cultivate that side of things for yourself and become a writer?
Not really. My goal initially was really simple. I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. And my goal was to get on, you know, the big talk show, The Tonight Show. And my, you know, heroes were George Carlin, Richard Pryor, and Robert Klein. They, you know, they weren't actors. I wasn't saying, gee, I want to be Pacino. Gee, I want to be Jimmy Stewart. No, it's like, wow, the comedians. And then it was literally an accident that I got cast into Diner. And then that led to everything else that followed. And so, in fact, Barry Levinson is very responsible for me becoming a writer. The year after Diner was made, they tried to make it into a series, and they did a pilot, which never aired. Maybe it aired, but anyway, it didn't go past there. I think it did air once. And I was the only cast member that was the newest guy. I was the only guy who showed up and was in the TV show. And Barry said to me, listen, why don't you take a stab at writing, you know, the next episode? I went, what? Yeah. And I went, all right, well, I know this character. I know this story. And I found it recently, and it wasn't bad for a guy who had knew fuck all what he was doing. It was pretty not terrible. And then, in fact, I had a deal. I was approached by the network here, one of the TV networks, to write a pilot for myself. And that, I think, if I remember correctly, that transpired because Barry Levinson had a relationship with them and pushed me and suggested to them, based on nothing, that, oh, you know, he could be a writer. And ultimately, I think I became a writer because I didn't know how to describe things. You know, you have to pitch. That's always part of the problem. You pitch your idea. And I go, you know, let me write it and then look at it. Yeah. And then see if you like it or not. And by the way, you're not going to necessarily know from the script. So let me make it. You know, it's like I have it in my head. But I'm not good at describing things. And I found I really do love the writing process. And but it, as I say, it wasn't a goal. I mean, I can look back and think, you know, when I was 10, 11, 12, we used to sometimes have an assignment and make up a story and perform it to the class. Well, that was an option. You could perform it for the class. And I always volunteered. I couldn't wait to perform it. So to me, they went hand in hand. Let me write this funny thing. And I remember even as a 10-year-old, I would put in jokes that wouldn't necessarily get the whole class to laugh. But my buddy in the back, he'll get this inside joke, which is so stupid. It's like, why would you lose 90% of the audience to get one idiot in the back? But so to me, the performing and the writing were always went hand in hand, you know, which is what stand up is. It's like, you know, I'm going to think of it. I'm going to write it and then I'll say it. It's like, so either way, it's my fault. You know, it's like I'm the guy in charge of this, for good or for bad.
But over the years, I mean, you've been doing stand-up this year as well. Over the years, I imagine you've inverted that ratio. So now you play for 90% of the room, and if 10% of the people at the back don't laugh, then you're happy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, but the truth is comedians only, and I think actors on stage too, you only see the one guy in the front not laughing. You're like, why is this guy on his phone? You know, it's like, yeah, but there's 1,199 people laughing. Yeah, but why did that guy stare? And why is he in the front if he's going to be so miserable?
Yeah. And that's a guy that's on your mind when you're driving home as well that night.
Always. You know, the drive home in general, the drive home is, I think, I don't know if this is true for most actors, that is where I shine. I'll film a scene and then it's okay. And I'm driving home and in the car, I'm going, that would have been great if I said that. Oh, if we can hurry up and bring the crew back because I was so good in the car by myself. Trust me, nobody could hear it, but I heard the tree fall and it fell, baby. That tree fell.
Was that the case on The Problem with People because you were a producer? Were you able to do that or were you nailing it before the drive home?
No, it was such a graced project. Everything fell into play after a lot of ups and downs. We stops and starts and then we had COVID and then we had schedule conflicts. But when we finally got to do it, everything fell into place. Colm Meaney and I had never met until the week we shot and just hit it off famously. And the crew was great. And as I said, Chris, the director, you know, we had the same film in mind. And so there wasn't a lot, you know, and I did have the luxury. I go, let me do another take, which maybe not every actor would have had the opportunity. But I went home at the end of every day and I couldn't, you know, pleased. I was like, oh, can't wait to do tomorrow's work. And then, you know, also in Dublin, you know, we had the luxury of like, let's go to the pub because it's light for another 7 hours. And so like you go to the pub and have a pint and now it's 11 o'clock. All right, let's go to sleep, even though it's light out.
So where did this come from for you, Paul? Because there's a scene in the movie where your character Barry is watching Local Hero. And that's one of the things that makes him decide to go over to Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it the same for you in terms of the movie? Were you watching Local Hero one day and went, I want to make that movie.
Yeah,
so I'm going to do that.
Literally. I saw that movie when it came out, and I was just so enamored with it. And I don't even know why. I've subsequently seen it, you know, dozens of times, and now I know why it was so appealing. But on the surface level, I went, wow, a high strung American goes to this beautiful picturesque town, in that case, Scotland. And I don't know why I changed it to Ireland, but I did. And I said, yeah, I'd love to make it. But it was really just a pipe dream. Like, well, that'll be fun. I'd love to go. And I actually have that line in the movie, which says, you always wanted to go. I said, no, I said, I'd love to go sometime. Like that, I did, you know, casually. But over the years, I would think about it. I was like, okay, what would that movie be? Yeah, I don't know. And I'd put it away. So it was nagging. It was always in the back of my head for years. Obviously, that's 1983, the movie came out.
Yeah.
And then a few years ago, I said, well, what's on my bucket list? What do I need to do? What do I want? I said, I really want to make that movie. And what happened was, you know, so I would stall out. I said, why would me playing an American, why would I go to Ireland? Somewhere in the early 90s, I went to Ireland, my wife and I, and loved it. And I thought, oh, God, it's just so beautiful. And I thought, well, why, you know, so I couldn't come up with this story. And I happened to mention to this woman who's a producer on a film, I was doing 2 days on this little bitty indie film. And I said, you know, I have this idea for an Irish movie, but I don't know, maybe I should write it with somebody. And she said, you know, I know a fella that might be just perfect. And she introduced me to this young guy, Wally Marzano Lesnovich. Name cannot fit on the back of a jersey. That's how the name is. I had never met him. He was an actor and a writer, and just a really great collaborator, just really upbeat. And, you know, I said, here's what I have. Where do you think we could go with it? And it was just an open collaboration. And again, I had the luxury of going, no, you know, like he said, what if this? I went, no. I wasn't, you know, he was helping me actualize this fantasy. So it was literally all I had was New Yorker goes to Ireland. Why? Well, what if it's a family thing? Okay, why would it be a family thing? And then we thought, well, what if there's a conflict that's precedes them, that's been generations in running, and these two, in the name of something larger, try to put it to rest? I thought, well, now that's a story. And so what excited me then once we had that, it wrote very easily, because it was, I saw where it could be funny, and I knew Colm Meaney and I would be funny together, and that. But the friction of two well-intended guys who are good people, but they're human and they can't get out of their own way and they can't stop becoming suspicious or vengeful. It's like, oh, well, that's the problem with people, isn't it? You know, so it was about a larger issue, if I can use that word, a larger concept packed into a funny, very digestible, silly comedy. And that's what appeals to me about, that's the kind of movie that appeals to me. It's like, oh, it's really fun and it goes down easy, but it leaves you with something hopefully a bit more thought provoking.
Yeah, I mean, not to give things away, but the movie ends on a very interesting conflict.
Interesting, let's which go is, with interesting.
As a football fan, I was very happy to see Tottenham and Chelsea in there as well.
Yeah, Tottenham got it, which then the word just literally flies by American audiences. Like, nobody even heard Tottenham.
What is Tottenham? What is it?
I had to go, my buddy Omid Jalili, who's a big footballer, and I said, what would be a good rivalry? He said, Chelsea, Tottenham. I said, thank you. But, you know, I was years ago, I don't know how long ago, maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I was in Israel, and I was invited to, there's an organization called One Voice, and it is made up of mostly young people, teenagers into their 20s, who are politically in the middle. They're anybody who's not extremist. And they were basically Israelis and Palestinians who wanted to find a way, how do we live with reality? And I'll never forget, there was, you know, and they were all lovely people, you know, they were not enemies. They were people like, we're here because we want to, how can we come up with a plan and that we can filter out to our families, to our communities, to, you know, because in most conflicts, it's the bare few on the extremes that are causing the conflict. The vast majority, I would dare to say, of any conflict are people, the vast majority of people in the middle going, can we just not do this? Can we not be fighting? And I remember this young woman, Palestinian woman, she said, look, and she was talking to an Israeli Jewish young man. She said, look, I know that my family has been here for generations. This is my home. I would never leave. But I also know that you feel the same way. So what can we do? And I thought, there it is. There it is. Here's, you know, I have a reason to be here. You have a reason to be here. What then can we do? And we even have that line in the movie, you know, where Coleman, you know, and he does it beautifully, but he goes, what is it that you'd like? What would you like? And my response is, well, what do you want? You know, but just opening that conversation is like, oh, because, you know, we probably want the same things. You know, any conflict, I'd like my children to be safe. Same here. I'd like my children to be safe. Okay. All right. So we have that in common. Let's build from there, which is the literally the dialogue in the movie.
I'm from Northern Ireland, and so you know, I lived through the Troubles. I know what it's like in many ways for there to be conflict that rips a country apart, and then for people to sit down and go, "All right, how do we tackle this?" And now there's an entire generation that hasn't grown that's grown up in Northern Ireland, not knowing violence.
Yeah, well, it was a beautiful movie that Colm Meaney and was it called The Conversation?
The Journey.
The journey. Yeah. And it's two guys in a car and going, okay, that's how small you have to make it. So you represent that side. I'll represent that side. Let's get in a car. What can we do? And thought, yeah, that's how it's done.
Absolutely.
That was a beautiful movie.
He's great. He's good people. He's called me. He's really good.
Man. He's great. I love him. I love him to pieces. You know, it was such an easy, relationship. You know, we could have not gotten along, which by the way would have been fine and would have helped the movie, I'm sure. It's like, oh, these two guys really don't like it. But we did like each other. And when we met the first time, we didn't talk about the movie. We didn't talk about the script. We were talking politics. We were talking, you know, family. And it really just came kind of effortlessly. And the thing that's so good, and I've always admired Colm Meaney, he's one of these guys, and it's not everyone. He's one of these guys that's never bad. You never watch a movie and go, he was reaching too hard or he was too, you know. No, he's good and solid. And solid is really the word. I mean, he is a compact motherfucker. He is a force. And he's really smart and really eloquent and knowledgeable and funny. And, you know, you don't want to get on his bad side, is my guess, because he would be a formidable foe. And that's part of what makes the movie, you know, we're both amiable guys. We both can be pretty prickly. We can both be grumpy. We both like our creature comforts. It's like, so, okay, this is going to be a perfect match. And it ended up, you know, on film, the response that we've been getting is like, well, you guys have obviously worked together often. No, just met that day.
That blows my mind. But I also want to talk about someone else you work with. I'm a huge Columbo fan. I'm a huge Peter Falk fan. Mm. And you had the pleasure of working with him on The Thing About My Folks. And
yes,
I just wanted to ask about that experience, what that was like for you. Did you have a similar experience with him as you did with Colm?
Yeah, I did. You know, both The Thing About My Folks and The Problem With People will be in the category of, see, if you can find it, it's worth watching. You know, they're not widely distributed, really tiny, tiny indies.
Yeah.
And those, to be honest, those were the two movies that I had in my brain that I said, I got to make these two movies. One was specifically, I have to make a movie with Peter Falk. And the second one after that was, I have to make this movie in Ireland. And the movie with Peter Falk, I just always loved Peter Falk. And then one time, I was back visiting my parents in New Jersey, and my dad happened to have the TV on, and he was watching some Peter Falk movie and laughing. Now, my father was a pretty easy laugher, but there was something like, oh, of course you like Peter Falk. There's something so similar. There was something, just some connection was made in my brain, like, Peter Falk as my father. That was I got to write a movie where Peter Falk plays my father. And he reminded me of my father. They didn't look alike or anything. But it's interesting, when we first, I went out to dinner before we made the movie. We went out to dinner, my wife, Peter, and Peter's wife, and we're leaving. And we're now walking to the car. And my wife goes, "Oh my God, he is so your fucking father." I went, "Right, he is, right? He's a He doesn't look like him, but there was something in the in his DNA. So it was literally, I just loved Peter. And that was, I was working backwards. Again, I had no story. I said, but again, it's, I sat with it for years. And then even after I had my first son, it didn't come clear to me. And then I had a second son and I went, I think I get it now. I get what I want this movie to be. And what it was at that age, you know, I was, I guess, early 40s. Mm-hmm. And my dad was gone. My mom was still around. And I, but I had always been fascinated by their relationship. They got, you know, they were married and together until my dad passed at the, he was just shy of 75. And they were fine. You know, they were, you know, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of frustrations, a lot of disappointments. And I always thought, you know, and I'm the fourth of four kids, so I got the tail end of them. But I always thought, well, what, they weren't always like this, right? They didn't, they weren't always just tired and running out of conversation and just fed up with each other. You know, all the, you tend to only see the irritability of your parents. I thought, well, wait a second. When they met, they were 26, 27. There must have been a moment where he went, oh, she's pretty. And she went, oh, he's quite handsome. And they dated and then they kissed and then things. And then here we are. Now you're watching the news and you're both tired and you're both. So what's that journey? So I wanted to write that. And the irony was, it was, the movie was 95% me and Peter on screen. It was a twosome, which, and it was the road trip that I wished I had always taken with my dad. I never did get that opportunity. But in my mind, it was a love letter to my mother. It was the son who had always felt his mother's disappointments more acutely than his father felt his wife's acute, disappointments. And I wanted to sort of flash it in his face. And so those scenes that I got to do with Peter was such a dream. I mean, it was a dream working with him. You know, and what I discovered in the writing and then certainly in the playing is like, gee, I thought oh, I'm being so noble and I'm defending and standing up for womanhood. And he's going, you know, you're missing half the story. You want to hear my side? It's like, oh, there's another side to the story. Oh, you know what? I didn't know that. Okay. Well then my bad. I didn't know. And I just loved Peter's voice and I loved the rhythm, his rhythm. So it was so fun to write and picture him doing this. And then there were these long speeches that he would just nail. It's like, oh, that's just how I imagine it. That's so good. And it's so good to hear. So there was, before we met, we had a technical meeting, a tech meeting with all the directors and the DP and producers. And they were at that point, we were still discussing what technology, are we going to shoot this on film? This was 2005. We're going to shoot it on film. We're going to shoot it on tape. If it's film, it's a 35 millimeters, a 60 millimeter, a 24. If it's video, it's a 24 frame, 12 frame, 48 frame. And Peter's quiet during the whole thing. And finally, dust settles and Peter goes, you know, you're all talking 24, 12, 34, 35, 36. You never shot in 75. And we said, what's 75? He goes, I'm 75 years old. I can't learn all these fucking words. and I went, oh my God. So the tail end of that story is this one. And he was concerned that he, you know, his memory was sharp. He was so sharp and so. I loved him. And so there's this one scene where I show him a letter that I uncovered that my mother wrote before I was born, basically accusing him not of adultery, but of not attending to her needs and not being there for her in the way that she would like. And the moment there's a, in the scene, and it was, Peter said it was the scene that made him want to do the movie. You know, he reads this letter and you're hearing the wife pour her heart out and you just go, oh, well, he's going to obviously hear her side of the story and go, I see it now. And instead he goes, bullshit. And I'm like, oh, okay. Here comes his side. And he lets loose. It was a 2-page scene of just him. And of him going, let me tell you, and here's what you don't know. And if I'm such a bad guy, then how come this? Cause I busted my back. And he just delivers it. And it's outside and he's pacing around a car that we had just crashed into a tree. Cause we were so agitated with each other. And the characters. And we did this scene. he does it all in one take. And then he gets to the end and the crew just starts clapping. And I happen to be standing next to my producing partner. He's got little tears in his eye. And he goes, "That's why I make movies." It's like, just to see Peter Falk do two pages of funny, tragic, heart-pulling stuff. So he was everything and it's a movie that not many people saw, but to my knowledge, everybody who saw it, who spoke to me, told me how much they loved it. And, it's the kind of movie you want to call your father afterwards, or visit the graveside. It was a love letter. As I said, it was written in defense of my mother, but it was a love letter to both my parents.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And then you get a call later on that night from Peter Falk on his drive home going, "I think I can do it better." You just need to get the crew back.
Yeah, no, he did, but one of the things I did learn from him, and people had told me, he can be quite cantankerous. He can be, and I said, I just adored him and would have given him anything he needed. And there were one or two times where he got really combative, not with me, but he was being rushed by the director or by their schedule. And there's one point where the director was trying to do something. It was a very talented director. And we were sitting at a table and Peter, the director wanted to do just, it was a long scene again. We were talking four actors around the table. And the director wanted, after he shot it conventionally, he wanted to do one where the camera moves continually on a steady cam, walking around the table. And Peter goes, "Well, how do I know where the camera's not going to be? When I say this line, you're not going to be behind me, sir." And the director was a little bit flippant. He goes, "Well, don't worry about it. We got it, Peter." He goes, "Well," and Peter was like, "Yeah, but you see, it's an important line. And if you're behind me, so how do we time it?" And the director's like, "I don't know." And Peter stood up and he flipped this huge mahogany table up in the air and down and went, "Uh-oh, okay." And he was just and then afterwards, he kind of was in his trailer and we let everything simmer down. And the director goes, "You go talk to him because he don't like me now." And I went in and he was teary-eyed. And he just said, "I just want to get the scene good." And I went, "That's what it is. He's not an asshole. He's never been an asshole. He's just cared."
Yeah.
He cared so much that he said, "You're not hearing me. And so I'm going to flip this table if that's what makes you hear me." I went, if everybody were like him, we'd be in good shape.
We'd have fewer tables, but we'd be
fewer
in better
tables,
shape.
Yeah. But you could eat standing up.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask about, you've had this incredible year. You're talking about bucket lists earlier on, and it seems that this year has been just extraordinary for you. You've co-written a book with Michael McDonald, which is wild. You're doing stand up. You were in returning to Beverly Hills Cop with Axel F, of course, and you co-wrote an Aliens comic book continuing Burke's story.
Right.
Which blew my
mind. I can't take too much credit for that one. That was, somebody came to me with the idea and said, "What do you think about a TV show, Burke Lives?" I went, "That's hysterical. That's really funny." And Adam Goldberg was a very successful TV producer here, was a big Aliens fan and apparently was a fan of mine. And he came up with this story of, a what if story, if Burke had lived and how did he live? And he inadvertently, without speaking to me, he came up with a very creative version of something I've been saying for 35 years is, Burke wasn't a bad guy. He was just misunderstood. And so without knowing that, he came up with this story that there was actually not only misunderstood, there was a very altruistic, very noble reason that Burke wanted to bring an alien back to Earth. But it didn't go well. Admittedly, there was it was a bad call.
It was a bad call.
So then they said, "Well, what if we do it as a comic book first?" And the people at Marvel were excited about it. And I said, "My son, this would be a good way to get him out of his room. He knows comic books and he loves seeing, could he?" And I just thought he'd be watching the writers or watching them draw. And he ended up being a great writer. And so I just would look at the script and I would periodically say, "Well, maybe Burke would say this." And it was an interesting thing because I had to, I had to remember these are not lines I will be saying as an actor. These are printed in a comic book in a little balloon, in a little dialogue bubble. So it's okay if it doesn't sound like me. It's not me. So I had to sort of sit back and let these guys who do know what they're doing. But it was great fun. And we're still talking about hopefully maybe getting it done as a show, which would be silly.
That would be amazing. That I would be there. Absolutely. Episode one, sign me up, please do. But it's fascinating. Because Burke, you're right. I mean, Burke is, when you watch Aliens, one of my favorite movies of all time. Believe me, I've seen that movie a number of times.
He is,
you know, he's sympathetic the first hour of that film.
Yeah. I remember hearing Jim Cameron, cast me because he was looking for somebody who could delay the reveal, an amiable guy, maybe somebody from comedy. And so, he thought that I could bring a bit of a disarming quality. But having said that, I know people, I'm on screen 30 seconds, people going, bad guy, that's a bad guy. Nothing good is going to come from that guy.
It's the collar, isn't it?
So it's the collar. Yeah, there's the collar. I'll tell you about that suit too. If you got a minute.
I had
multiple meetings before we even went to London to shoot the film. We shot it in Slough, which is, as you know, is the beautiful part of the world. and they put us up in a hotel, like a motel. And I was saying, our motto was, in Slough, no one can hear you scream. So we all ended up moving into flats in London. But before I went, I had like three wardrobe fittings for that suit. And they were taking, you get a suit, you measure six different things, the inseam, the jacket, the shell. They did 40 different measurements from your elbow to your eye, from your colon to your toe. I'm like, wow, these guys are doing something fancy. I don't know what the suit's going to be, but it's going to be something. And then I get there, and it's a regular suit, but the collar is up. I went, is that what I had three fittings for? So you can put the collar up? Doesn't seem like that was worth the effort. But I was sure. I was like, this is just like a blueprint, right? Like, no, that's the suit. I went, oh, boy, that's time I'll never get back. I'll never get that time back.
Yeah.
But, yes, so that was fun. It's been an interesting – yeah, but to me, it's really culminating with the release of this movie, which has occupied so much of my brain and my energy and my heart for so long, and it's out now here in the States, and it's coming out imminently over there. And Chris Cottam, the director, his sort of mission statement for himself in production value of the film, he said, "I want the people in Ireland to look at this and go, yeah, that's right." That we're not being cute. We're not being, Colm Meaney said when he read the script, he was so relieved that it wasn't like so many other scripts he's read, Americans writing Ireland, and it's all top of the morning and leprechauns and, it's just cliches, bullshit.
You got the language right, I think.
Yeah, well, and I had an Irish writer look at it. I go, tell me if my sentence structures are, so there were a couple of places where the actors too would say, we would say it this way. I said, please make it real. So the lines were written, but sometimes I remember this one line where Colm says, oh, I don't trust him. He goes, oh, do you trust him? And the other guy says, well, why wouldn't I not? And I said, No, it's why would I not? He goes, well, why wouldn't I not? I go, wait, that's two knots. What? He goes, well, that's how we say it. I went, oh, then say it. God bless you. If that's how you say it, makes no fucking sense to me. But if you want to say it, you go ahead. And then now when I hear it, I go, oh, it sounds perfect. That sounds beautiful. And it's like there's, there are so many in Irish jargon, they put the word so at the end of the sentence, or but at the end of the sentence. I want, well, it's too late to mean anything. The sentence is over. I'll have a cup of tea. So, huh? No, so yep. I'll have a cup of tea. That's how you say it. No, we don't do it. We put the so at the end. And it took me a minute to go, I don't understand it, but I love it.
Yeah, in Northern Ireland, I think it's an Irish thing as well, but we like to reaffirm things at the end of sentences. So we'll say, I'm going to the shops, so I am. Or, I had a great night, so I did.
Well, there was a line from Goodfellas, and they only did it once, and it was one of my favorite lines, where he's doing the narration of showing all the mobsters in the bar. He goes, and that's Tommy two times. We call him Tommy two times because he says everything twice. He goes, "Yeah, I'm going to pick up a paper. Pick up a paper. I'm going to get the paper. Get the paper." And so that became a thing in my family. We used to walk to the driveway to pick up a newspaper when we still got newspapers. And my kids would do it. They didn't even know why they were doing it. I go, "Dad, I'm going to get the paper. Get the paper." I went, "Oh, these poor kids. They don't even know what they're saying." But and I kept waiting. And every time I watch Goodfellas, I go, "You're not going to call that back ever? I just need it once. Do it once more where he says something twice for no reason at all. I'm going to get the paper. Get the paper." Because the implication is that you don't believe me after the first time. Yeah. Or yeah, I want to lock it in. Yeah. I'm gonna go to the pub. So I am.
Yeah, I want to see a Goodfellas what if with that guy. That's what I want to see as well. Paul, I'm gonna let you go, but there's just one last thing I wanted to say real quick, which is sure. I wanted to ask about Whiplash, another one of my favorite movies. I had the great fortune a couple of months ago to see it in London with an orchestra performing the score live, and the drummer at the end of that doing that live is one of the most astounding things I've ever seen. It's extraordinary.
He was playing it to the film.
Absolutely incredible. Barely missed a beat. It was extraordinary. Standing ovation.
How do they do that? So is there a band playing on top of the soundtrack?
There's a band on stage. They drop the soundtrack out. The band provides the soundtrack. They're playing to a click track as the movie goes. It's one of the most incredible things. They do it a lot over here with films like Superman and Lord of the Rings and things like that. But this was the first time I'd ever seen a jazz orchestra do it. And I was on Whiplash.
Yeah, and you're watching musicians on stage and in the film.
Oh, yeah. It was absolutely incredible.
Fine, that sounds fun.
Oh, it was incredible. But I just wanted to ask about your experience of shooting that. Because your character is there for that scene. He's there for that moment. But I imagine you weren't on set whenever they were filming that bit, or were you?
I was hanging around. For the end piece, when I have to show up. You know, that was another example. You know, you end up doing things for different reasons. And sometimes you do something because you're bored, or sometimes you go, "Well, that's a great script. Let's hope the director is good." Or sometimes you go, "Gee, it's a great director, but maybe he'll make the script better." So you never, you know, but you just need some element, or like, "Well, that's shooting in a beautiful location," or whatever. And in the case of Whiplash, before I read the script, I saw the short. There was a short that Damien Chazelle had made as a sample, basically, presentation to get investors. So he shot it for something like $50,000 maybe. And it was 17 minutes. And it was with J.K. Simmons, but it wasn't with Miles Teller, another actor. But J.K. Simmons popped off the screen. And it was brilliant. Mm. And I remember I said, "Well, I don't know why you're sending me. This is great." And they said, "Well, they're doing a feature." And I remember thinking, "Why would you fuck with this? This is like a great 17-minute movie." It was that middle chunk, you know, he's throwing the chair, it's all, but it was suspenseful and beautifully shot. I said, "This is great." And I also said, "There's no father in that scene. So what part are you talking about?" So then I read the whole script and I realized, oh, okay, that was just part of this script. Then I read the script and I thought it was beautiful. And, but again, you know, there's a million ways that movies might have good intentions, but don't materialize. And there's any number of reasons that films don't end up great. And so it could have been a mediocre film, you know, and if you look at it on paper, it's like, so it's a kid and he has a terrible asshole teacher and there's music, you know, if you see a script and it goes the last pages and then there's a big scene and he does a big solo and then it'll be good. Like, oh, that's an iffy proposition, but it was so brilliant. And even still, when I watch, I go, "Wait, there's no more dialogue coming. We're going to go out on this. We're going to go out like this 7-minute war between J.K. Simmons and Miles Teller, played to music." And I went, "Oh." So, you know, I was sort of the only voice of reason in my character in that, you know, it's like, and as a father, I had already come to learn that, this is 10 years ago, my kids were teenagers. It's like, you know, there's only so much you can do to guide your children, and they will, especially when they come of age, they will do what they're going to do. And you can only suggest and pray and try to put more, you know, pour more good guidance into that vessel, but ultimately it's out of your hands. And that to me is what broke my heart reading. It's like, here's this guy and his life was not great, like the father, and his, you know, but he was a great father. And now he's watching his son just go down a path that's not going to end well. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. So, you know, it was a great joy to play that. And then I saw the film, it opened the Sundance Festival in the opening night. It was the opening film in the big theater, 1,200 seats. And it played like a horror film. Like nobody, I didn't even know. And people were sitting next to strangers and you grab everybody's arm. Oh, he's going to throw the chair. He's not going to throw the chair. Oh, he threw the fucking chair. Oh my God. You know, it was such an intense experience. And I remember afterwards riding in the car with Damien, my wife and his wife, and we're going to the after party, whatever. And I said, and he's such a calm, cool young guy. And he was like 26 maybe at the time. I said, do you understand this moment in this car? This is exactly what every filmmaker in the world wants. You just opened Sundance to a great response. There is now buzz aplenty. This nothing but buzz. People are already buzzing. You are on your way to the party to drink champagne where there's going to be a bidding war for your little movie. And he's going, yes, cool. I went, no, it's more than cool. I don't think you understand. Just enjoy it, whatever your dynamic is. But this is exactly, and you know, it doesn't happen often. But that, in that moment, I was thinking, oh, this guy is a major talent. And you know, and then he followed it up with La La Land. And you go, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
He's pretty good.
Yeah. 10 years from now, Damien, people will be playing your movie with a live band in front of a sold out audience in London. Yeah. Pretty cool. Yeah. I guess it's all right. Yeah. Well, Paul, I lost you temporarily there, which is a sign that our time is up. So I'm going to let you go. It's been an absolute pleasure. So it has. And I'm going to let you go. It's been terrific. Thanks so much indeed, Paul Reiser.
All right. Thank you. Great talking to you.
Okay. That was Paul Reiser. And just to explain, yes, his signal did drop out. He disappeared. And then when he came back, we took it as a sign that our time, which had already run over quite substantially, was over. But I had a fantastic time talking to him, and I hope you guys enjoyed that. The Problem with People is out in cinemas from tomorrow, Friday, November 8th. So do seek it out. See if it's playing at your local cinema. The regular Empire podcast is also out tomorrow. It features guests Hugh Bonneville, Emily Mortimer, Andrew Arnold, and Jack Schaefer. It is an absolute cracker. And this week, if you are a Spoiler Special subscriber, you will see, or have seen, or will be seen, or maybe, anyway, we put up two Spoiler Specials for Transformers 1 with director Josh Cooley, and an Agatha All Along series Spoiler Special featuring that Jack Schaefer interview in full. So if you don't already subscribed to the Spoiler Specials, then my word, you are missing out. Now is the time, folks. empire.supportingcast.fm. All right, that's enough for me. So it is. I'm off to turn my collar up in honor of Carter Burke. Is that a bad call? Yeah, probably. Anyway, thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.